Now, how about 1916? What, when, and where should we engage in commemoration? I think we have to, many different candidates. First of all, we have the transformation of battle at Verdun and the Somme. My first nominee, therefore, for 1916, and there will be many events of this kind in 1916, is the 21st of February. Here the German army, under General Falkenhayn, the second commander, the first von Moltke, who ran the Schlieffen plan in 1914, had a nervous breakdown when he realized it didn't work and that the German Empire was effectively in ruins. The defensive capacity of the German army, the finest army in the world in the First World War, stopped that defeat from, as it were, arriving until 3 years later. One of the leaders who followed him, the second commander of the OHO, Falkenhayn, launched an assault on French fortifications intended not to take them, but to draw the French army into a battle of attrition which would bleed it white. There is some controversy as to Falkenhayn's real motives. Why? Because the only piece of paper that he wrote saying what he was doing, he wrote after the end of the battle. And we, as good historians, ought to take note of the capacity of generals to change reality to fit their own personal needs. Maybe he wanted to have a battle of attrition. Maybe he wanted a breakthrough. More important than his logic was the logic of the battle itself, going back to the claim I made right at the beginning, that the generals didn't command battle. Battle commanded the generals. This is one of the, I think, most important issues to realize. These were battles on a scale the world had never seen before. And it shouldn't surprise that those in command were unable to command and that they themselves were the victims of the logic of their own plans. They didn't pay the price, though. Verdun remains, it was and remains, the longest continuous unbroken battle in history. It lasted 10 months without a break and achieved nothing. French soldiers who moved up the Voie Sacrée, the enormously crowded road from Bar-le-Duc to Verdun, could see it glowing on the horizon day and night without a moment of respite. And after 10 months, in November 1916, when the French took back all the gains the Germans had made in February, that battle achieved nothing other than approximately 700,000 casualties. Now, nothing in the Second World War comes close to Verdun in its intensity and ongoing ferocity. Not even the second battle to commemorate in 2016, the Battle of the Somme, the landscape of which you can see there. Not even the Somme compares to Verdun. The Verdun didn't even have trenches. It had isolated positions of soldiers whose purpose was simply to stand there until either they were killed or the German advance moved back. The Somme had lines. And the Battle of the Somme, which lasted for 5 months, nonetheless topped Verdun in casualties. Of course, estimates of casualties are always subject to imprecision and frequently to lies, but whatever the final toll of life and limb on the Somme, it was well above 1 million men. It was a battle the world had never seen before. That is a moment to commemorate, and the 1st of July 2016, is it. Now, part of the purpose of understanding the, as it were, the elegiac sense that the brief film I showed you at the beginning has brought to millions of people who are both fascinated and horrified by the history of the First World Wars, is that it created images that the world had never seen before. It's the prehistory of surrealism. There were images. This is a German soldier's body in a tree. This one is half a horse in a tree. I give you these as only, as it were, light versions of the photographic horror that you can find in the First World War. It's that what war looked like was just like everything else and unlike anything else the soldiers had ever seen before. And I think in many respects what we have to appreciate is that the battlefield, and the battlefields of the First World War, on the Western Front in particular, resembled the dark side of the moon. They were simply landscapes that were visually impossible to describe. And in many respects, this is one of the reasons why commemoration has to observe silence. Silence is a very powerful language of commemoration. There are some scenes which simply defy language, and understanding the battlefield is one of them. What about commemoration in 1917? There are two moments linked in 1917 which deserve commemoration, and this is irrelevant. I don't think it matters to hoots that the Soviet Empire collapsed and the Soviet Union is long gone. The two moments that changed the world in 1917 were the first, March Revolution of 1917, and the second was the November Revolution of 1917. Using the earlier calendar, you can talk about February and October. But the important point is that in the initial revolution, propelled initially by a women's strike in Petrograd on International Women's Day, unrest grew to the point that the Tsar abdicated. But then the new government, the provisional government, made a fatal decision to continue the war. After a futile offensive on 1 July, which turned into a rout 2 weeks later, support for the provisional government slowly evaporated. In late October or November, the Bolsheviks overthrew the provisional government and then proceeded to withdraw from the war. The date of 25 October or in the old calendar or 7 November in the new one will be commemorated. But not because of the birth of communism, but because of the end of the war. Lenin was the most successful anti-war leader in the world. He's the only political leader who brought the war to an end. And that's why he survived. The Bolshevik Revolution could not have survived without bringing bread, peace, and land, and above all, peace. Now, initially, I think we have to appreciate that 1918 brought revolution of many different kinds. There are points in the calendar to mark, though not to celebrate. I'll suggest 9th of November, 1918. Not 11th of November, but 9th of November. It was when the German Revolution overthrew the Kaiser and launched the first democratic regime in German history. That's the date to remember. The end of the old imperial autocratic regime and the beginning of the first German experiment in democracy, for which the German people and the rest of the world should be thankful that they had a second chance after 1945 and indeed after 1989 to fulfill. 9th of November 1918, the moment when the German people discovered democracy. Now, there are other days in 1918 that I would suggest we should look at. The first is the 8th of August, when the German army gave up any lingering beliefs in victory. But the problem with that date is that it gave birth to the myth of the stab in the back. The German army, immediately upon recognizing that they couldn't win the war, created a set of lies about who was responsible for it. They themselves, the German high command, stabbed their nation in the back, but found it easy enough to transfer the responsibility for that defeat to the new regime that made the peace, that signed the armistice and signed the Paris Peace Treaty 6 months later. Now, the German defeat was sealed on the 8th of August and then put into political terms on the 23rd of October, 1918. 19 days later, representatives of the new regime took responsibility for signing the armistice engineered by the old regime. This is the beginning. That very day, the 9th of September, is the day when the German Civil War broke out. Why? Vacuum of power. The Kaiser fled to Holland. He had to abdicate. Woodrow Wilson was the first, but not the last, American president to believe in regime change as a way of installing democracy in countries at war. The important thing is he wouldn't negotiate with the Kaiser. The Kaiser had to abdicate, and he did. He hated the idea of abdicating as King of Prussia. He could get rid of the empire without much trouble, but he was really attached to his crown in Prussia. But he had no choice. He was driven to the Dutch border and to the absolute shock of an ordinary Dutch postman handed over his ceremonial sword as a sign of his defeat. The new German Republic was born, and that is a day, I think, that commemoration would be well worthy of organizing. Now let me offer a new date for the commemorative calendar suitable for 1919, and again it will be one that nobody's ever celebrated. It's the 4th of May. I suggest that we have a commemoration on the 4th of May, 1919. Why that day? On that day, it was right in the middle, not quite at the end, of the negotiations about what the peace treaty would look like. And on the 4th of May, the Chinese delegation of the Paris peace talks received the message that the big three, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Woodrow Wilson, had decided to return Shandong province south of Beijing not to China, but to Japan. Now, the Japanese Navy was extremely important in the naval war of 1914-18, and indeed had responsibility for the defense of the west coast of Canada. I have photographs of Japanese cruisers off the west coast of Canada while the U.S. Navy was elsewhere in the Atlantic transporting 2 million men overseas to France. The Japanese Navy brought Australian and New Zealand troops to Alexandria, and then they were taken to Gallipoli. They had real power, especially shown after the defeat of Russia in the Russo-Japanese War. The Chinese were engaged in a civil war, which made their military power very, very limited, but they offered 150,000 laborers to dig all those trenches on the Western Front. Now, what that meant was the negotiations favored the Japanese over the Chinese. Now, this decision to give Shandong was a massive humiliation to the Chinese, one they have not forgotten. There will be a meeting in Shandong province in Jinan on that day, and I suggest that it's a good day to commemorate. This exposure of the hypocrisy of the Allied commitment to self-determination was a reward for the contribution of Japan, clearly. China couldn't claim such military or naval power. So when Wellington Koo, one of the Chinese delegates in Paris, cabled home on the 4th of May, the decision of the Allies, he didn't receive an answer for 4 days. The reason was that Chinese students, on hearing of the decision, burned down the telegraph office and much else in Beijing besides. Then they went on to their university compound and formed what they called the 4th of May movement, out of which the Chinese Communist Party emerged. What a day to mark, the day that Woodrow Wilson and his allies did their bit to create the Chinese Communist Party. You want to see the transformation of the geopolitical structure of the world? Celebrate the 4th of May. Not as a moment of war, but as a moment of the chaos that the war brought in its wake. Now, the reason why that date should be commemorated is that it heralded another feature of the war we need to recognize. That is, this is a war which did not have an end. As I just noted, most people think that 11th of November is the day the guns stopped. Not so. They kept firing all over Eastern Europe and Asia. They fired against massive crowds demanding a say in the peace in Cairo. They fired against demonstrators in Jilian Balawag in Amritsar in India, killing over 1,000 people. They fired against Koreans in Seoul, 1 million of them, demanding independence from Japan on the 1st of May, 1919. They fired, too, all over the Anatolian Peninsula, where Mustafa Kemal Ataturk led a refashioned Turkish army defeated in the war to liberate its territory from occupying British and French forces, who left, and against Greek forces who fled together with over 1 million long-term Greek residents of the Ottoman Empire. This is the, as it were, sign of the immediate end of the war. It's the beginning of the European Civil War between Bolshevism and National Socialism, born almost immediately after the end of the conflict. And what's intriguing about these two posters is that they drew upon elements of wartime propaganda and simply changed the enemy. Instead of the Allies being responsible for the blood of the world, it was the Bolsheviks being responsible for the blood of the world. And instead of fighting against those who wanted to take your homeland from the West, now is the time to join the Freikorps, the paramilitary troops, and to prevent those from the East from taking your home. Here's an example as well of what the Japanese were doing to show their power and their place within the international order. There was intervention in Russia to stop the Russian Revolution in 1919. It all started when the Allies in Versailles tried to deal with the Russian Revolution in about 10 minutes. The reason why it was so constricted is that Woodrow Wilson created something called the State of the Union message, which still exists to this day. And that meant he had to go home from Paris. He had to leave Paris and go in a car to a train, to a boat to get to Washington in order to address Congress. And dealing with the entire world as his agenda meant that Russia and its confusion was something they put off time and time again. And as he got up from his chair to go to the car, to go to the train and so on, Winston Churchill put up his hand and said, "Mr. President, can we please discuss the Russian problem?" And Wilson looked at his watch and said, "You have 10 minutes. So they sat down, and Winston Churchill said, "This is the worst regime ever seen in history. We have to do something with military force to put it down." Woodrow Wilson said, "I don't believe in that at all." Churchill said, "Perhaps we should create a commission to look into the matter." Wilson said, "That's a good idea," and off he went. And Churchill used that commission to legitimate 6 different Western armies and the Japanese, but at the local memorials, the local monuments to the dead of the Great War. The further away we go from capital cities, the closer we are to the small groups of men and women who did the work of remembrance during the war and in its aftermath. These were the sites of mourning for those who could not go to the battlefields, who could not go to the national capitals. Here is an eclectic set of images of them. My intention is to show the varieties of messages of all kinds that they represented. Relatively few of the war memorials that I've seen are triumphalist. There are some, but they're relatively few. The bloodbath made that pose difficult for the families of the dead to take, and these were created for the families. War memorials were places where women entered the narrative of war, where they came to do the work of mourning. Have a look at these. The first is in the village of Anyan in the Ardèche in the south of France. Peasant families lost their sons. Peasant families are sculpted on the local memorial. The same is true for the village of Bouilly-les-Mines in the Pas-de-Calais, a mining and textile region. Here, grandparents lead an orphan to the local war memorial to see the name of his father, because the name is all that remained. What we should understand that the First World War inaugurated is that war was not only a killing machine, but a vanishing act. 50% of the men who died in the First World War have no known graves. 50% of the men who died vanished. That is exactly the same percentage of those who died in the attacks on 9/11. 50% vanished without trace. The First World War opened the century, if you will, that reached the World Trade Center on the 9th, on the 11th of September 2001. This is another image of the same war memorial showing you how important the names are. And the cult of names, the cult of naming, follows directly upon the disappearance of the bodies. This is clearly the preparation for the extraordinary search for names that followed the Holocaust and went all the way to Buenos Aires and the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. The cult of names is the cult of warfare in which war is not just a killing machine, but a vanishing act. This is a memorial of a different kind. This is from the Ariège, the center of France, and shows a much broader range of emotion, fear, horror, and astonishment. This is an interesting one because it was done by a former soldier himself. More unusual is this plaque on a war memorial in Chaumusy in the Marne. It provides cameos of the faces of the men who died. Once again, the intimate, direct, familial quality of the commemorative site is striking. In the British Isles and the Dominions, the tendency was to use somber, meditative, reflective statues to represent the solemnity of loss of life in war. There are triumphalist images here and there, but most are like this one. Let's see if I can find it. No, I've left it out. There's one I should have put in from the village of Enniskillen in Northern Ireland. The reason why I should have put it in, and I forgot and apologize, is that the site is poignant. It was the target of a murderous IRA bomb attack in 1987, killing 11 and wounding 63. Now, many of the British groups on the local level decided to choose an obelisk. Why? Because they had a reformation to get rid of the cross as it were, a site of idolatry. Obelisks also had the great advantage of being the cheapest form of statuary. And this mattered on the local level because the local level is the place where people paid for these. States didn't pay for them. Ordinary people did. Now, in Australia, war memorials are similarly laconic, restrained. They have the distinction of listing all men who served, thus pointing out by omission those local residents who didn't serve. War memorials, therefore, were chastisements. Now, this brings us to the second side of the pilgrimage appropriate to the centennial commemoration, and there will be many commemorations at this second site. Tens of millions of people will make the journey from around the world to war cemeteries and to the battlefields surrounding them. This, too, is a reiteration of the journeys made in the 20s and 30s of those who lost sons or fathers and who could afford the fare. But we're luckier. In real terms, travel is 7 times cheaper today than it was in 1925. Huge crowds will come to these sites on specific days. For Australians, it is Anzac Day. For the British and Irish, it is the 1st of July. The same date is sacred to Newfoundlanders, then colonials, now Canadians, who mark the 1st of July because of their courage and sacrifice at Beaumont Hamel. Now, I choose to discuss a couple of these because of their unusual character. The first point to notice is that this is not the Latin cross. This is a medieval cross of chivalry. And one of the extraordinary features of British, that is to say, more generally, imperial and now Commonwealth war graves, cemeteries, is their ecumenical character. These are cemeteries of a non-Christian kind. Yes, there are crosses on the stela, but at the same time, the iconography and the horticulture is not restricted to Christian notation at all, which extraordinarily annoyed many Christian prelates at the time. So this is a medieval cross of chivalry in one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commissions in France. This is what they look like. English country gardens in which the, as it were, the horror of war is expressed in the beauty of as peaceable a kingdom as one could find for the men who died in that war. This is a German First World War cemetery. They're on balance much smaller than the English or the French, or the Commonwealth, first imperial, now Commonwealth War Graves Commissions of the French, for obvious reasons. The French were loath to give large tracts of lands to the people who had been thrown out after 4 years of occupying their territory. So most of them have common graves. That hill in the back is a common grave, rather than the graves that are particularly associated with one individual. We know about the cenotaph, and again, think of the ecumenical character here. The cenotaph is a pre-Christian symbol. It's a Greek symbol. It's a symbol before. It's not the symbol of the empty tomb of Christ. It's a symbol before Christianity. And Dean Inge, the dean of Westminster, was absolutely furious that there was no cross on the cenotaph. When it was first done on the 19th of July, 1919, 5 days after Bastille Day, it was done by Edmund Lutyens in Plaster of Paris because they had to put up something for the victory parade, which first happened in Paris and then in London. But the British people as a whole voted with their feet for this as the National War Memorial. 2 million people came and deposited whatever they could. They left small objects, symbolic exchange. The dead had given everything. They at least could give something. And as a result of it, the British cabinet asked Lutyens to turn it into a permanent memorial where it is today on Whitehall. But it wasn't Christian. It was for all those 500,000 Muslim troops fought for the British Empire. There were Hindus. There were Jews. There were people of no religion at all. And hence the, as it were, statuary of commemoration where pilgrimage will happen motions, as it were, points us towards what I would call globalized mourning, where the terms are no longer national. They are transnational. And Lutyens, the architect of genius, who had created New Delhi, the architect of empire, was the man who saw them. Now, this is a war memorial that I'm going to certainly go to each year of the Great War, on the 10th of October. I'll tell you why. On that date, the son of these two people, the woman in granite bending over, is the sculptress, artist, Katie Kollwitz, and her husband, Carl, who is, as it were, engaged in gendered emotion, you know, a man holding his emotions in, a woman bent over in resignation, on their knees, asking for forgiveness from their son and all the other young people who had no chance to have a life, who didn't have the good fortune of living at a time where they could die one at a time, but died all together. Their son, Peter, tried to persuade them at the beginning of the war that joining up as a volunteer in the German army was just and right in defending his country. They were against the idea, but felt that his honor, his sense of honor, had to be respected. They regretted that for the rest of their lives, and it took Katie Kollwitz 18 years to design this particular war memorial. I've been there in many seasons, and I don't know if others of you know this too, but this part of Flanders is a place where it almost always rains. Now, I have no idea whether Katie Kollwitz knew about this. But the statue always cries every time I've been there. She created it in such a way over 18 years, and it was extremely difficult for her to design it in such a way that it created a sign which made commemoration, in my view, an extraordinary sight. And it is there and in those circumstances that I believe that we need to understand what commemoration does. This is, by the way, another one of her, as it were, her style of sloping a woman's body to describe the resignation of a mother losing her children. This is in the Neue Wache in Berlin. It's a national monument. There's a story behind it, which simply is that this statue was never that size, but the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl decided he needed one to symbolize those who died fighting the Nazis and the communists. And so he appropriated it and ballooned it in a form that still exists to this day. The family wasn't asked. That's not the way German chancellors operate. But the shape of the body is what I'm interested in pointing to you. Now, the last one that I want to talk to you about goes back to Lutyens. And this is perhaps a visual expression of the point of my lecture. The visual expression is simply this, that here's a man who was the architect of empire. And here is the Arc de Triomphe. But look what he did. There are two things that he did. My eyesight is particularly bad. My students' eyesight is much better. But if you notice, there are white facades on the trunk of those small, as it were, relatively small arches. At a certain vanishing point, all of a sudden, the names appear. This is the monument to the missing on the Somme, the monument to those who have no graves, 73,000 of them for just the Battle of the Somme. Now, the important point there is that it is a reenactment of the tragedy of the war, because as you walk towards it, the names suddenly appear. It's as if the disappearing act of war can be reversed through the cult of names. But not only the cult of names. Let's see if I can do this. Maybe. Yes, I can. If you notice, each of this arch, there are four of them at the base. And what Lutyens did in his design was to turn this arch around and make it 2.5 times larger on the side that we can't see, and then do it again and make the arch 2.5 times larger at the side we can see. Now, each time the arch is made 2.5 times larger, the empty space in the middle is multiplied as well. Until what is it on the top? What do we see on the top? We see triumph reduced to nothing. This is an extraordinary sight, which was the symbol, the model, again, a turning point in the representational arts. This was the inspiration for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington that Maya Lin designed and became the fundamental representation of the loss of life in war. And the reason is its simplicity. The extraordinary feature of First World War commemoration is its simplicity, in that the distinction between celebration and commemoration is simple. It simply takes a certain form of courage to maintain. Now, the third places that I want to draw your attention to, very briefly, in conclusion, are war museums. So aside from war memorials and battlefields, there are places to go to now. And this is actually a cartoon that I can't resist showing you. I found it in Auckland, New Zealand, where they have a war memorial museum. And they did it in early on, this is 1921, and they asked various people to design it, privileging veterans. And the question was, what constitutes a war museum? Now, you'll see that the title of it, it's a museum memorial, we don't know which it is. This idea of how do you balance the notion of a museum, which can be celebratory, guns and weapons can be, and how do you make it a memorial? Very difficult. Here you see a disappointed architect committing suicide. Here's a statue of a prominent citizen who would give money for the thing, and therefore they would change his name every week. Here is the mixture, as it were, of the museum and memorial. Bugs and beetles, other entrance, come to see these wild animals. And the one that I find most poignant is here is a returning soldier who fruitlessly is searching for the war. He can't see it in the museum structure. Now, this suggested design for a memorial by our infant prodigy says everything there is about the problem of war museums. What are they there for? And there is the reason why I'm going to close with this set of images today. War museums are, in many respects, very important in our national culture. They were intended to be tributes to the men and women who endured the tests of war. They have very little room for recording the history of anti-war movements, and in their presentation of weapons and battlefield scenes, some, though not all, tend to sanitize war. Now, these are the guns many of you have seen, naval guns, outside of the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth in London. And the point is, the Imperial War Museum is a very important site of memory, extremely important. And the question of balance between commemoration and celebration is one that is being negotiated now. It's being redesigned. And it's being redesigned, I think, validly. Here's a second war memorial museum, which has enormous power. This is the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. And it is, you may be able to capture this very easily, its dome is deliberately shaped in the model of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople and Istanbul to bring back the notion of the greatness of the creation of the nation on the shores of Gallipoli. Now, going back to the Imperial War Museum, this is part of it that I personally can't stand. It's called the Trench Experience, and it's a way of representing the war in a form I call pseudo-realism, where there are plastic rats and there's all kinds of dust, and these are, needless to say, plastic characters, as if we need to somehow turn the memory of war into an adventure story, or perhaps even worse than that. This, by the way, has been repeated in a museum at Meaux on the River Marne. This is a maquette of a trench, a model of a trench, as if, you know, creating it in its own in its own way requires all kinds of false moments of reiterated artifice. Now, this museum is one that I personally helped put together. It's called the Historia de la Grande Guerre, and we deliberately made it look different. First of all, there's a lot of concrete, and everything is underground. The second point about it is that the horizontal axis is the key element in the organization of space, on the grounds that the vertical axis is the axis of hope and celebration, and the horizontal axis is the axis of commemoration and mourning. The same thing can be said about the use of weapons. I particularly like this trilogy in room 3 of our museum. It's basically a syllogism. Attack, defense, surgery. And in the surgery, in those surgery, we have some of the items that kept the French writer Genevois sane when he engaged in writing about the First World War. Well, in the conclusion of that museum, we try to raise a question that I'd like to leave you with today. My central point is this. I believe that these sites of memory, museums, war memorials, battlefields, cemeteries, are the cathedrals of the 21st century. They're places where sacred questions are posed and occasionally answered. Eternal questions about sacrifice, death, love, betrayal, loyalty, devotion, suffering. In many parts of the world, many more people go to museums than go to churches. On a Sunday a few weeks ago, I passed Trinity Anglican Church in Lambeth just after having visited the nearby Imperial War Museum in London across the street. I was struck by the enormous contrast. While secularization has taken its toll on our churches, the sacred has not vanished from our field of vision. The sacred has simply moved out of the churches and inhabits other places. Those places are where we should commemorate the Great War. Museums, cemeteries, battlefields, archives, monuments. Perhaps we can understand more of the force of the song I played for you right at the opening of my remarks, sung by the cathedral choir of Salisbury Cathedral. And like a cathedral choir, these voices, which we can hear and feel, proclaim not the innocence, but the humanity of the men who died in 1914-18. We cannot ignore the fact that soldiers were executioners as well as victims. They joined up because they believed their cause was just. And though many words may be appropriately attached to them, innocence is not one of them. It's an interesting contrast with the poetry of the period before the war. They didn't get the war they asked for. They fought the war that was given them. The story we hear about the war in the song I played and in many others is about the sheer waste, the stupidity, the inhumanity of that war we call great. It was the greatest calamity ever seen, a calamity which opened the door to even greater disasters. How then must we answer the question I set at the outset of my remarks? How should we remember the Great War 100 years after? Through meditation, through pilgrimage, to local war memorials, to national ones, to war museums and war cemeteries, and to the battlefields in which they are enfolded. Pilgrimage is hard. Tourism is easy. Take the hard way and reflect on the fate of millions of men who did not have the privilege we do of dying one at a time. Stand where they stood. Read the inscriptions on their gravestones. Read the names, because in most cases, that's all that is left of them. Their name shall liveth forevermore, says Ecclesiasticus. That was the phrase chosen by Kipling to mark every single Commonwealth War Graves cemetery. He knew of what he spoke. His son vanished during the Battle of Loos in 1915, and his body has never been found. His name is all that remains. In making these journeys of remembrance, I believe we are engaged in a political act. I believe that the current memory boom arising from the two world wars has been a powerful catalyst for the progressive delegitimation of war in our times. Let me put a daring proposition to you. I'm sure not everyone will agree with me, but I want to put it to you anyway. Should it be surprising that Tony Blair and George Bush lied about weapons of mass destruction in order to pass legislation enabling them to go to war in Iraq? They had to lie, since without such an alarming cause, it is no longer politically possible for nations to go to war with the support of the people. Popular opinion on both sides of the Atlantic won't have it, as Iraq demonstrated a decade ago and the Syrian crisis today demonstrates quite emphatically. Since the 1980s, after the Falklands War, war has lost much of its glory, its honor, its popular and political appeal, though computer games show that simulated war still has its attractions. Commemorating the Great War, then, is, in my view, a moment to honor those who died in war. As part of a commitment to render such moments of slaughter not only illegal but unthinkable, visit these sites in the next 5 years or so, choose your dates, and vote with your feet. What better act of commemoration can there be? Thank you. Thank you.